and sometimes very painful deaths, you think my support of you means that you're not going to die ever? Or you're not going to die of this illness or the other illness? No, the issue is that whatever happens, including your death coming, and the way it happens, I'm your wali, I'm doing it in your favor. We have an abundance of hadith talking about painful death for a believer. The Ahlul Bayt telling us painful death for a believer is a blessing for that believer. Painful death for a believer is a blessing for that believer. Allahu waliyul ladina amanu. He's a mu'min. She's a mu'min. She went through a very painful death. We on this side sit down like, oh my God, why did this have to happen to this person? Hadith says, the Imams have told us, that is a blessing for that person. If that person wouldn't have gone through that because of their own deeds, they would have ended up having certain punishments post-death. And whatever is post-death, whether it's in barzakh, in qiyamah, or in, God forbid, in hellfire, much worse. We're sitting back, we're like, oh my God, this happened to this person. So what? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala actually gave this to that person in their favor. These are our teachings and many more that are related to this. Why are we panicking? Why are we as believers panicking? There's no need for any type of panic, any type of fear. There's responsibilities. Yeah, we have certain responsibilities. We're going to take care of those responsibilities. What's going to end up happening with that? You may do all of that. If Allah wants to take you, He will take you. You sanitize everything. You go to the store, grocery store, you bring it, you put it on the deck, you wipe everything off, take it in. Well, you think you're doing it. You think Allah is not in control of that. All it takes is 1 second. You don't even realize. You didn't pay attention to one little corner. And that tiny little virus ended up on that one little corner. That one little corner ended up in you. And you got the virus. And God takes you if that happens. You doing your responsibility doesn't mean you're not going to be taken. God tells us, go to war. Do your taklif in war. Does that mean you're not going to die in war? Actually, you're supposed to love to get killed in war. Istishhad, becoming shaheed. Doing your taklif doesn't mean you're not going to get killed. Doing your taklif doesn't mean you're not going to lose your life. Doing your taklif doesn't mean you're not going to get the virus. These are two different things.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen Ghafur Shakurun Wadud Qayyim وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very
answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Salamun alaikum and welcome, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding their Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are mostly based upon the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. We have in our studio guest speaker, Sister Sukaina Taqawi, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Salamu alaikum and welcome to the program, dear Sister Taqawi.
Alaikum salam. Thank you for inviting me to this program.
Thank you for coming. We shall start with a question, inshallah. My 16-year-old boy has asked me to buy him a motorbike because all his friends have one. A few months ago, he had asked me to buy him a specific mobile just because all his friends had it. I would appreciate if you can give your advice on this. Should we fulfill his demands, keeping in mind that we're not financially strong?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. This problem, I think, has to be solved gradually, step by step.
Okay.
The first thing the parents have to do is to be firm.
All right.
Firm and firmly tell their child that it is not possible for them to buy this motorbike or the mobile, or it is not possible for them to fulfill this demand.
Okay.
Why? You know, sometimes parents are not financially weak. They have the ability to buy. But the fact that he wants this thing just because his friends have it,
okay,
is not right. Right? We have absolutely to teach our children that they should not want things
just because their friends
have it. Just because their friends have it. We have to buy things because we need them, not because others have it.
Yes, yes.
Right? So the first step is that we have to be firm. We have to tell them no.
Okay.
Right? It is not possible.
Mm-hmm.
The second step is that then gradually explain them, especially for those people who are not financially strong.
Okay.
Right? They have to explain their children that we should be happy with what Allah has given us. But this is a very gradual process.
Okay.
It cannot be done in one day or one night or in a few days. Although this starts from childhood. You know, we have to make our children strong from childhood.
Exactly, yes.
It is too late to start training, but...
But it's never too late.
Yeah, it's never too late. So what can the parent do is, the first thing is that be firm. The second is that explain him gradually.
Okay.
And... How can he explain him? He has to find the reason behind why his child is demanding this.
Okay.
What is the reason? What has happened, you know? Like, why does he want that thing? There can be several reasons for this.
Okay.
Right? It can be out of jealousy.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, you know, the child is jealous. He doesn't want the other person to have that.
Okay.
It can be due to peer pressure.
All right.
This peer pressure sometimes is very difficult to tackle.
Yeah, it is.
The children, due to peer pressure, because he thinks that if the parents don't buy him a motorbike or a mobile, right, the children, the friends will make fun of him, or he's going to be left out.
Okay.
Now, over here, we really have to act cleverly and we have to think and act. We have to weigh the pros and cons.
Okay.
Especially for those who can afford. For those who cannot afford, right?
It's a different question.
It's a different question. But for those who can afford, they have to weigh the pros and cons. Sometimes if they don't succumb to the demands of their child, you know, it's going to be more harmful. You know, the feeling, the child, he's going to feel left out. He's going to feel bad.
Okay.
So they have to, sometimes they have to succumb to the child's needs.
Okay, before we continue the questions, let's take a break, dear listeners, and we'll be back soon. Stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Yes, Sister Taghi, you were talking about how to solve this problem with a 16-year-old boy who's been demanding stuff from their parents. And so you mentioned that, you know, the parents should be very clever on how to tackle him. So first they have to be very firm and then gradually explain him that.
Yes, exactly. You know, that so here there are two types of parents. Yes. Those parents who can afford, those who cannot afford.
Okay.
For those who can afford, they have to weigh the pros and cons.
Okay.
Because sometimes when they say no, you know, it will be more harmful for the child. So there sometimes they have to succumb to the demands of the child.
All right.
And sometimes when they see that no, this time if they say no, it will not be as harmful as it, like it could be in the other case.
Okay. If they don't get that
thing. If they don't get the thing, if they don't fulfill the demand, it's okay. So over there they have to be firm. Because the child has to learn. He doesn't have to have everything the other person has.
Okay.
Right? And for that family, for the family who cannot afford.
Okay.
For that family, I would say that they should try and make friends with people who are at the same level as they are. You know, their financial level, their financial status should be the same as their financial status.
Okay.
Right? They should send their child to a school where the children who come to the school are on the same level. They should have the same financial status.
Okay.
Right? Because if they send the child to a school where rich people come, the child will feel deprived.
All right.
Okay. So for those people who cannot afford, they should try and make friends, you know, in their own circle. People who are like themselves.
Okay. So if I got this right, you mentioned that for those who can afford, should they get it or shouldn't they get it?
No, over there, like, I can't say for sure that they should get it or they shouldn't get it.
Okay, they have to weigh themselves and see which one is more harmful.
Yes, they have to judge.
Okay.
Right, they have to see their times. They should, you know, succumb to the demands of the child. Their times, they have to stand firm and say no to their child.
All right, okay.
And the second reason why this child is demanding such things, what is the reason? To solve this problem, we have to know the reason.
Exactly.
Right? The second reason can be our own upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That how have we brought up our children?
Okay.
How have we trained them? Because, you know, usually we hear that the child has to mention one thing and the father fulfills it. Gives in. Right? Although, as I said, that there are three phases of tarbiyah, of upbringing. Mm-hmm. Right? In the first 7 years, the child is a king. You know, they give an example. They say that who is a king? A king is someone, he just gives orders.
All right.
But when will he give the order? He will give an order according to his thinking.
All
so we have to change his thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And who changes the thinking? The wazir.
Minister.
The minister, the one who advises him.
Okay.
Right? So when we say a child is a badshah, the child is a king, right? It's the work of a parents to work on their mind.
Okay, so that's for the
7 to 14 years, the child is a slave.
Okay.
So there's a different way of tackling the child.
Okay, so now we're talking about the third.
The phase between 14 years and 21
years. The third stage,
The third stage, right?
Okay, before we continue the question, let's take a break, dear listeners. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "No father has granted a gift to his child better than good manners."
Welcome back. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Yes, Sister Taqawi, we were talking about the son, the boy who was who's been demanding stuff from his parents. And you mentioned that we should take care about his upbringing. How have we brought him up? And have we always, like, given him what he wants? Or have we taught him that he should not get what he wants always?
Yes. So this all depends, right?
Yes.
This all depends of how we have trained him.
Okay.
How we have brought him up.
All right.
If we have tackled him well in the first 7 years, in the next 7 years, then we will have less problems in the third 7 years.
All right.
But now, as the mother says, that she has a problem.
Okay.
Right? How should she tackle?
All right.
So the reason is, one of the reasons is because the upbringing was not according to the Sharia.
All right.
Right?
Okay.
You know, when we succumb, when we give, when we fulfill the demands of the child,
mm-hmm.
although there are ways to do it.
Okay.
But when we say yes to everything the child wants,
mm-hmm.
right, in other way we are spoiling him. So when the child grows up, he will expect the same from the parents.
Mm.
You know, we never know. We have to prepare our child for hard times.
Okay.
There are times we have to give him facilities. There are times we have to deprive them of facilities.
Okay.
It is because we have to prepare our children for hard times.
Yeah, that's part of training.
Yeah, that's part of training. The third reason as to why the child is asking, is making such big demands, is that maybe he's taking a few people as his role model. You know,
okay.
Those people who he takes as his role model mm-hmm. have all these things.
Can you explain a bit more
right.
about that?
When we see the lifestyle of Mr. X, we see that he has the best car.
Okay.
He has the best mobile.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he changes his mobile after every year, after every 6 months. And the child, he wants to follow that person.
All right.
And this is a very big challenge for parents. In the third
stage,
the 14 to 21 years, this is a very dangerous age. Usually
okay.
our children, you know, go after actors. They go after footballists.
Okay.
Right? Usually they adore their friends.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to really be careful.
Okay, so we have to be careful about everything, like
yes, we
who
have to
they
be
take
careful,
as role
yes.
models.
And this all depends on our training, that how have we trained our child from his childhood.
Okay.
Really, have we really shown him the right role models?
Okay.
Have we really shown him that whom he can't follow?
Okay, so if somebody has come to a stage where he has wrong role
right.
models, then
yes, yes.
what should the parents do then?
Yes, so this is a big challenge, and the parents have to teach their child. It will take time, but it's a gradual process, but the child has to be taught.
Mm. So, Sister Taqawi, the time's up. We will continue with this question in the next program, inshallah. So, till now, we talked about a 16-year-old boy who is under peer pressure and is demanding stuff from his parents. And you mentioned a few key points, that we have to be firm with the youth and not give him whatever he wants, and gradually explain them that we have to be happy with what Allah gives us. But for that, we have to actually know why he demands all these things. You mentioned three points. One is could be because of peer pressure, and the second could be because of our own upbringing, that we always give them whatever they want. And the third one is that maybe they take a few people as role models and try to follow them and in their footsteps, and that's why they want to have whatever they have. So inshallah, we'll continue with this question in the next program. Thank you very much for joining us, dear listeners. And dear audience, if you have any questions, any comments, any suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. And subscribe to our YouTube channel and Facebook page, Call of Islam Radio. Inshallah, till the next program, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
the United States remains on a collision course with the International Criminal Court, even after the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump yielded power to the Joe Biden administration, which was expected to be softer on issues related to international organizations. The reasons for the troubled relations have remained unchanged: the ICC's decision to probe war crimes committed by the United States and Israel. ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda, who has been probing war crimes committed by Israel, the U.S., and their allies, said in December 2019 that such crimes have been or were committed in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. She named the Israeli military, which has for years unleashed a reign of terror on Palestinians, as the perpetrator of war crimes. The ICC prosecutor further noted that there was a reasonable basis to launch a probe into Israeli military actions in the besieged Gaza Strip, as well as illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. Bensouda then asked judges to rule on the extent of the court's jurisdiction in the case, and the court last month established that it had jurisdiction. The announcement was not received well by Washington and Tel Aviv. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a phone call that the U.S. opposes any such probe as the court has no jurisdiction over the matter. The phone call followed U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken's statement that Washington firmly opposes and is deeply disappointed by the decision.
If the state is very certain and very secure that the Israeli regime and these occupiers have not committed war crimes, so why not give a chance to the investigators, the bipartisan group that will be coming in, that is not biased, and they will be investigating all the cases that they have in their files, in their system, and to prove that they're innocent, right? And then at that point, we don't have this continuous problem coming up and arising again.
The U.S. and Israel have repeatedly shown their opposition to being held accountable for their actions over the years. The ICC, which has often sought to expose war crimes committed by the Israeli regime and the U.S. around the world, has faced bullying and intimidation from both Tel Aviv and Washington. The Trump administration imposed sanctions on the Hague-based tribunal staff last year, targeting them with asset freezes and travel bans, accusing them of violating the U.S. national sovereignty by launching a probe into war crimes committed by the U.S. troops in Afghanistan. The Biden administration took no immediate action to reverse the move, despite promising to put overruling Trump's damaging measures on top of his agenda. The new U.S. administration did announce it would rejoin the United Nations Human Rights Council, which its predecessor withdrew from 2018, citing an anti-Israeli bias, but it said upon re-engaging with the UN body, it will press to eliminate a disproportionate focus on its Israeli ally.
I mean, this shows essentially from the beginning that they're not going there really for human rights. They're going there to secure and support Israel and to bury their war crimes and to get people away from holding the Israeli regime accountable. I mean, why is there all these resolutions in the first place against Israel? Obviously because there's continuous developments, there's continuous war crimes, there's continuous bombardments, there's continuous blockades, there's continuous crimes.
We will be back. And I'm a man of my word. America is back. I speak today as President of the United States at the very start of my administration, and I'm sending a clear message to the world. America is back.
Joe Biden has repeated this sentence multiple times since becoming president, taking a veiled sideswipe at his predecessor's isolation foreign policy and promising a return to multilateralism in a bid to win over the estranged U.S. allies and revive the frosty transatlantic relations. While Washington's European partners have largely expressed support for his administration, divisions between them still persist. In the latest example, an EU spokesperson said, "The bloc supports the ICC as an independent and impartial judicial institution with no political objectives to pursue." Peter Stano was responding to a request for comment on Netanyahu's recent diatribe against the court, who had blasted the war crime probe as, quote, "the essence of anti-Semitism." President Biden says he will bring back what he calls America's moral leadership in the world. The question is, how can the U.S. advocate such leadership while it continues to penalize those who work to expose crimes instead of the true culprits?
recent coup in Myanmar has taken the time back to 1962, when the military took control of the Southeast Asian country 14 years after its independence from Britain. Since then, the stage was set for military's power play until 2011, when Myanmar underwent democratic reforms and began parliamentary elections. The military junta seized power on February 1 and declared a one-year-long state of emergency after detaining the de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and members of her National League for Democracy Party, among other elected government officials. The military claimed that the November election, in which Suu Kyi's party won with a landslide, was rigged. However, the Election Commission nullified this claim, stating that there was no evidence. While the ousted leader is under house arrest, Military Commander-in-Chief Ming Aung Hlaing has taken power. Despite public opposition, he attempted to justify the takeover by saying the military is on the people's side and would form a true and disciplined democracy. That is while the military junta says it wants to hold a free and fair election once the state of emergency is over. However, the country has lapsed into chaos since February 1 coup, sparking daily mass protests as well as global condemnation. The U.S. and the European Union are weighing up imposing sanctions against the junta leaders. The U.S. already has imposed some sanctions against some of the major junta leaders. Nonetheless, the military has ignored the international outcry and responded to the public opposition with escalating force. So far, 50 people have been killed and hundreds arrested during the military junta's lethal crackdown on nationwide anti-coup protests. Wednesday marked Myanmar's bloodiest day since the military takeover. The UN Special Envoy on Myanmar confirmed that 38 people lost their lives after security forces opened fire on protesters demanding the return of civilian rule in the country.
Well, I guess nobody knows why, but my speculation is that they are the ones who hold on to the power at this moment, and they are very motivated by having the power, whether economically or running the country. So now, because they are taking over the country by force and nobody wants to have the military run the country, and therefore people are standing up for their rights, and that is exactly what the dictators, the Burmese government, junta, doesn't want it.
Since the deadly military crackdown on the Rohingya Muslims in 2017, Aung San Suu Kyi's government has faced international condemnations. Following that, the West's interest in Myanmar has faded, and now with the military coup and the bloody crackdown on demonstrators, Myanmar is further alienating itself from the West. Moreover, as the Southeast Asian country is currently grappling with the impacts of the coronavirus pandemic and the military coup on its economy, the U.S. and the European Union are considering imposing sanctions. That could worsen the current crisis in Myanmar and push it into an ally's corner, namely China. The U.S. has already placed sanctions on Myanmar and has condemned the junta leader's harsh crackdown on the protesters. Moreover, the EU has also come out and condemned Myanmar's military, suspending development funds for the country. Yet what is interesting is how the Southeast Asian nations have so far rebuffed U.S. sanctions, which, in their words, has given the generals a lifeline.
The most important thing that we also need to understand is that Burma is one of the countries where China invests most. So, for example, we're talking about the projects that are linked to the China-Myanmar Economic Corridor, which is part of the Beijing Big Belt Road Initiative that looped together a series of strategic ports, railways, and pipelines across the globe.
No Asian country has come out supporting the sanctions and anti-Myanmar actions. In this instance, China can therefore benefit economically from Myanmar, as trade with the West is now restricted.
The volatile situation in Iraq has become a major headache for the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden. It is largely a legacy from Trump's tenure, which was marked by chaotic policies and dangerous decisions in the region. Biden came into office amid rising anti-American sentiments in Iraq and growing calls on Washington to pull out all American forces from Iraq. Biden's team is now faced with growing attacks on American and U.S.-led foreign forces there. Does the problem have a military solution? Despite Biden's promises of change, the White House must still be thinking that it does. Because last week, Biden ordered airstrikes on anti-Daesh resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border in what his team described as a retaliation for earlier rocket attacks against American and U.S.-led forces. The U.S. airstrikes drew condemnation from resistance fighters and pledges of retaliation. On Wednesday, a barrage of rockets was fired at the Ain al-Assad Air Base, housing American troops in Iraq's western Anbar province. Advanced air defense systems at the Ain al-Assad Air Base failed to intercept the incoming rockets. Some observers believe the aerial bombardment ordered by Biden has backfired and has made U.S. forces in the region less safe.
It backfired because it was despicable, and this was seen throughout the region. Everyone sees that America's just dumping its garbage on other people's heads. So it's very bad for the whole region, if in America's terms, because it increases anti-American sentiment everywhere.
Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq are nothing new. Anti-Americanism in Iraq was fueled by the devastating U.S. invasion of the country in 2003. Iraqis were infuriated by U.S. forces' attack on civilian areas and their horrific crimes in the years that followed the invasion. But the latest wave of hatred of America perhaps began in early 2020, when the U.S. military assassinated Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror icons near Baghdad's airport. Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis played a key role in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group in Iraq and elsewhere in the region. The assassination triggered the Iraqi parliament to vote days later to expel all U.S. forces.
The Iraqi parliamentarians almost unanimously voted to expel all U.S. troops, period. And, of course, nothing has been done on that. So if a year ago the sentiment was like that, then it's only increasing. America is the enemy. America doesn't seem to get it through its head how it's perceived in Iraq and Afghanistan, wherever in the world.
But America is still refusing to heed to that call. It has instead deployed more military hardware and missile systems to Iraq in a bid to protect American forces. Such advanced systems have failed to make U.S. bases safe, with rockets still landing on them. The U.S. usually says such attacks are carried out by what it calls Iranian proxy groups. But Tehran insists that it has no proxies, but it has friends in Iraq. Many Iraqi leaders, political parties, and military groups in Iraq are friendly to Iran. Their ties grew stronger when Iran helped Iraq defeat the Daesh terrorist group. Last year, Trump withdrew several hundreds of U.S. troops from Iraq, but a much larger number still remain there despite his pledge to end American military presence in the region. How will Biden deal with the situation now? Observers believe by ordering the recent aerial bombardment on the Iraqi-Syrian border, he definitely had a bad start. If Biden stays on the same dangerous course, he risks further destabilizing Iraq and broader clashes with resistance groups.
Yemen has recently been the scene of deadly clashes between Ansarullah fighters and forces loyal to the former president Abd Rabbah Mansur Hadi, who aimed to capture the strategic northern city of Ma'arib. The fighting left at least 60 people dead on both sides Saturday. This after army forces and allied fighters continued with their push towards the oil-rich city, Hadi's last urban stronghold in Yemen, which is some 120 kilometers east of the capital, Sana'a. Reports said that a high-ranking pro-Hadi military commander from Ma'arib's provincial military police also got killed. But last Friday was the bloodiest day since the start of the offensive on February 8. More than 60 people died in that fighting. Reports said the dead included at least 27 pro-Hadi militias. Meanwhile, on Saturday, several civilians, including a child, got killed in a Saudi-led airstrike in Yemen's western province of Hodeidah. The Yemeni media said that a drone raid targeted a residential building in the city of Hodeidah, also injuring several others.
The war being waged by the Saudi royal family against the people of Yemen, which is the poorest country in the Arab world, is an illegal war. It's a war of aggression, and it's also illegal in the targets that it takes in Yemen. 233,000 people are reported to have been killed. These are civilians who have been killed by Saudi air attacks. And a child dies every 10 minutes, according to UNICEF, in Yemen due to hunger and to lack of medications. And that's because the Saudis are illegally blocking aid coming into the port of Hodeidah. So everything about this war is illegal.
The attack comes as the sixth anniversary of the Saudi invasion of Yemen is near. The conflict has killed hundreds of thousands of people and displaced millions. It has also reduced to rubble much of Yemen's infrastructure. The United Nations has described the situation as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UN's humanitarian agency has warned that more than 16 million people in Yemen will go hungry this year as Saudi Arabia presses ahead with this notorious war. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said that 500,000 Yemenis are already living in famine-like conditions. It said the risk of large-scale famine has never been more acute than now. According to the agency, years of conflict have created enormous humanitarian needs in all sectors.
The famine caused by the Saudi war on Yemen is part of the illegality of the war in general. It's been caused because the Saudis have been blockading the ports of Yemen, especially Hodeidah, and preventing international aid from coming in, aid that has been mandated through the United Nations and agreed to by the parties at international conferences. But that doesn't stop the Saudi coalition from trying to starve the people of Yemen into submission.
The UN says that at least 60% of Yemenis are food insecure, and 16 million people do not have access to safe water and proper sanitation. The war impact, compounded by the blockade and the coronavirus pandemic, has battered Yemenis. But all of this would not have happened from the beginning if the U.S. and its allies had not provided logistical military support and military hardware to Saudi Arabia.
It's shameful that the U.S., the U.K., Canada, France, Italy, and other countries have been selling large amounts of arms to Saudi Arabia and its allies, such as the UAE. These arms have allowed the Saudi coalition to wage this illegal war on the people of Yemen and to cause widespread death and famine.
The Biden administration says it plans to stop arms sales to the Saudis and to stop supporting their war in Yemen. Many would consider this move as too little too late, because Riyadh has already packed its arsenal with huge quantities of arms that it bought from the previous administration and other Western governments, especially the UK. But almost 6 years into the war, the Saudis are facing an impasse as they have not made any significant gains on the battlefield. They have suffered many humiliating blows from the Yemenis who, unlike their enemy, have stood their ground. The latest attack on Riyadh is one example. What the people of Yemen want to see at a minimum is a meaningful move by the West and the UN to effectively end this war that will go down in history as a war in which the U.S. backed the Saudi-led coalition and committed war crimes in that country.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to IRIB English Radio and the program for humanity. I'm Sayyid Wahid Alawi and I greet you with the greetings of Islam. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We were talking about one of the rights of the book, the Treatise of Rights. From Imam Sajjad, Imam Ali Zainul Abidin, the great grandchild of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam, Haqqul Mustashir. And as previously said, we were going through the art of giving advice, because not everyone is born with those skills, and surely you need those skills when you give advice. And as I mentioned earlier, at least 13 times in the Noble Quran, advice in giving advice or seeking advice has been mentioned. The tips that I gave in previous programs, I will go through it very fast and go straight to the point, which was tip number 15 and forward. Number one, examine your motives, your intention. Number two, be sensitive about how to bring up a subject. Number three, avoid giving advice in the form of reprimand. Number four, keep privacy whenever you give advice. Number five, always ask permission for giving advice. Number six, listen first. Number seven, consider the other's frame of mind. Number eight, offer advice without insisting. Number nine, avoid making judgments. And number 10, avoid threatening people when you give advice. Number 11, be specific and brief when you give advice. Number 12, avoid compelling others to follow your advice. Number 13, give advice as an act of worship, not as a habit. Number 14, show some humility when you give advice. And we reached tip number 15 in the etiquette and the art of giving advice. And number 15 is practice what you preach. That is a key rule which should always be in our lives. The one who grants advice to his brother in matters of faith and concerns himself with mending affairs of his own life has granted an excellent gift and fulfills an obligation that was due on him. Further, he that gives good advice builds with one hand. He that gives good counsel and example builds with both. But he that gives good admonition and bad example builds with one hand and pulls down with the other. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "It is most hateful to Allah that you should say that which you do not do." And brothers and sisters, we should be very, very careful here, because here we have the issue of nifaq and hypocrisy sneaking in within our hearts when we do not practice what we say. We don't walk the talk. All right, we're going to go for a break. Please join us after the break. Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir. Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio and the program For Humanity, and we were talking about the etiquette of giving advice from the treaties of rights and the right, specifically the right of the one who seeks advice, Haqqul Mustashir. And we reached tip number 16, consider misunderstanding. Be aware always of the fact that advice is not always well received. Giving an advice requires a great deal of patience and devotion in case the person you are advising attacks you verbally or even physically. You should never return the harm. Number 17, be kind and gentle. It is narrated from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, gentleness is not to be found in anything but that it adds to its beauty, and it is not withdrawn from anything, but it makes it defective. Thus, one ought to be gentle and kind while giving an advice. Such method is agreed upon between all religions and cultures. Some people say that advice is like snow. The softer it falls, the longer it dwells upon, and the deeper it sinks into the mind. I will mention it one more time. Advice is like snow. The softer it falls, the longer it dwells upon, and the deeper it sinks into the mind. Finally, it is important to mention that giving advice is an essential trait of a Muslim character. A Muslim should always be ready to give genuine advice to his fellow brother or sister. And it is also narrated from Jarir ibn Abdullah, companion to the Prophet, I came to the Prophet and declared, I pledge my allegiance to you in Islam. The Prophet said, on condition that you pray, give charity, and offer advice. Jarir then said, I thus pledged my oath of allegiance to the Prophet and to Islam. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon this Prophet, Muhammad al-Mustafa, who gave such a blessed advice to all of us Muslims to have in all of our lives. On condition that you pray, give charity, and offer advice, he says to this companion, Jarir ibn Abdullah. That's all for today's program, dear brothers and sisters. You can contact us and please forward your questions to our email address, which is englishradio@irib.ir. And you can also listen to us in parsetoday.com. Parsetoday.com. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of
the
life.
Keys of life.
Akhil Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We finished speaking about the etiquette of eating, and now we're going to talk a little bit about the etiquette of drinking. We've already explained the importance of what keeps us alive, our source of energy, food and drinking. We've explained a little bit about the material, physical side of food, the spiritual, mental side of food, and how they both intertwine. The Islamic approach to all of this, where there is always going to be the element of alamul ghayb, where we assume that there is absolutely no relevance and no connection, but in reality, based on verses from the Holy Quran or based on a hadith from Ahlul Bayt alayhim wassalam, there is a connection. And this connection is not this relationship is not a conventional one. It's not something that is nominal or made up. It is something that is real. You know, we know the verse in the Holy Quran that someone who unlawfully steals or uses money from the orphans unlawfully, the verse says, إِنَّمَا يَأْكُلُونَ فِي بُطُونِهِمْ نَارًا. In reality, what they are consuming is fire in their stomachs. Now, it's a completely different topic, by the way, but just to reiterate something that I've continued to mention, where we need to understand that there's always going to be that relationship between this alam, this realm that we live in, this material, physical realm, alamun nasut, this realm of kathra, this realm of multiplicity, where we, in our minds, we try sometimes as much as we can not to be influenced by the material world, but unfortunately, because we are so engrossed in this realm, you know, we find it, sometimes we might find it difficult to comprehend this, especially in this day and age where everything is to do with trying to prove things through science and eliminate that which is sacred and question the status quo and all these other things, you know, that are happening around us. So I think one of the wonderful benefits of the books similar to this that give you that akhlaqi side of how to improve your material and spiritual life, you know, and these kind of books that have been written for the purpose of expanding our vision in thinking towards that which is going to benefit us on a greater scale, you know, that's what's going to really, you know, bring about that change in our lives and change in society as well.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
The fundamental focus of akhlaqiyat in Islam is when it comes to how we are able to understand and build our relationship with Allah, our relationship with ourselves, our relationship with others, our relationship with nature. And if I was to observe all four of them equally, if I was to make sure that I am catering to my needs when it comes to building a relationship with God and making sure that God is content with what it is that I'm doing, and I'm following and obeying the commands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I'm making sure that I'm tending to myself. I'm making sure that I am taking care of those who are around me. I'm making sure that I'm taking care of nature. All these things are going to contribute to a better society. Even if you were not a practicing Muslim or you were not a Muslim, you would still benefit from these kind of things. Because ultimately, that's what everyone wants. Every sane person wants to live a better life. Now, Islam says, well, these things carry meanings. There are meaningful elements to all of this. You know, that's why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created certain things, certain animals, a certain creation for a particular purpose and others for another purpose. Once we transgress with these rights, once we become negligent when it comes to these things, that's when big issues and big problems start to happen. And we know about the climate issue and all these difficulties that are happening. I think one of the main things that we are able to see when it comes to this topic, the topic of the etiquette of drinking, is that water in Islam is looked at as something very, very sacred. And, well, we're not only talking about ma